Well, welcome to Pulse Carbon Radio, and today we help you get ready for a Trump era. And before that, holidays with family, co-workers, and friends. How can we talk to each other productively across the liberal-conservative divide? And in particular, what strategies will work and not work to talk about that very difficult, emotionally charged subject, climate change, with people who do not share our orientation? Today, we are pleased to be joined by author and researcher Scott Wagner.
Scott Wagner is a longtime liberal activist in Sonoma County and a social psychologist. He has just published The Liberal's Guide to Conservatives, an explanation in layman's terms of the sciences behind America's ideological divide. He's currently on promotional tour of the U.S. for the book. Welcome, Scott.
Oh, talk to you.
Sorry, we just brought your mic up, so now we can hear you. So where we catch you on the road today? Are you in Canada?
I'm in Canada, yeah. I'm in Montreal. It is snowing in a lovely fashion. It's been doing for a couple of days. Other than that, it's been sunny and beautiful. It's a lovely city.
Great. Well, it's nice here, too, so we have that going for us as well. So we're going to dive into your book, The Liberal's Guide to Conservatives. This book does a number of things. It characterizes differences between liberals and conservatives, both in terms of personality and in terms of ideology. It covers some of the research that explains those differences, and it has some strategic advice for liberals, particularly based on what you've learned about how to better relate to conservatives as we go about our lives, including as political beings. Would that be a decent summary?
Sure. That's pretty good.
Okay, great. Let's see what we can cover of that in this hour. There's a lot packed into this book.
So, Scott, let's start off with what first got you focused on the subject 6 years ago?
You know, I was doing a couple of essays that, or a series of them actually, that were about the relative approach of, say, liberals with religion versus conservatives with religion, and then science and a few other things. And I got about halfway into that process and just discovered that, particularly in the 3 years before that, from 2007 on, there had just been some astounding academic work, and I really got hooked because I discovered how very fundamental to our being ideology is, and it's that way in a sort of secret way. People just sort of shove it all over into politics, and we treat it as if it's this little tiny part of our lives, but actually it's a very broad based differential that we have and needs to be addressed that way.
Great. Well, we're going to get to the concept of ideology in a minute, but first, we just want to define the most basic terms that are in the title of the book. I would say in common parlance, we use the terms liberal and conservative to represent two mainstream poles of identification and discourse. And in that sense, those terms don't include either the radical left or the radical right. Would you agree with that? Is that how your book is pitched?
Not really. Okay. I don't want to get too intellectual here, but I think there's a concept called essentialism that is really important, and I think over the coming years it'll be, hopefully people will appreciate a little bit more, and that is that it's everything is mushy, you know, and when you start trying to make these really, they sound very scientific and antiseptic differentials between things, you run into all kinds of problems, and so I don't want to disagree with you, but at the same time, I just want to caution us all, really, to make sure that we're not ignoring the very mushy notion, the mushy nature of life. And I try to cover this a fair amount. You know, saying someone is liberal there are so many problems with that term, or conservative, but it turns out that statisticians can limit a lot of the problems so that we can at least walk away with ideas that are powerful and useful to use. And that's what's important, not knowing exactly what a liberal is and whether it includes the radicals or just the moderates or, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay. So as we said a minute ago, you write about both ideology and identity. liberal and conservative represent both personalities and also ideologies. So we're going to get to the personalities in a moment. But first, let's talk about ideology, which you brought up when you first started speaking. I think of ideology as meaning a system of thinking. What does ideology mean in your work, and why is it so important?
Well, it's funny. For me, ideology, first of all, the term ideology is a very broad term, and what it and there's actually a very precise and clear and some wonderful science that's been done on it, particularly internationally, and what it basically means is that is ideology is the notion of taking a specific idea or a clump of ideas and running with them about a field. So it's really just saying you're slicing off part of reality and running with it really hard. And that's a really useful way to think of ideology, because it shows you that you're dealing with a part of reality in whatever the field is, because you're choosing to ignore certain parts. And this is the real value of the science of ideology, some of the work that I just discussed very briefly in the book, mostly in an appendix on the subject, that just shows that there are things. I mean, even if you're butterfly collecting, there are ideologists, and there are patterns for what ideology causes problems with that are quite apart from politics. But if you can just think about the notion of running with partial truths or part of the picture, by definition, and leaving aside things that might be important in any given analysis, may not be, but might be, then over time, kind of statistically, you're going to end up making certain kinds of mistakes. And that's what it means to be a victim of ideology. That's why I often say that I was born a liberal. I'm congenitally liberal, which means that I'm sort of forced to be an ideologist, if you will, or forced to be a victim of ideology, but it's something that I resist constantly and that I believe everyone should, for all kinds of reasons that I get into in more detail in the work.
If you just tuned in, this is Post Carbon Radio on KWMR. Today we're talking with author and social psychologist Scott Wagner about differences between liberals and conservatives and how to deal with them. I'm sure everyone's curious to hear what you've learned about the differences in our personality types as liberals and conservatives. So let's get into that. Tell us about the liberal personality. We might think we know ourselves, but what are liberals like?
Sure. When I got started in this work, what really, really excited me was the discovery of neurological differences between conservatives and liberals. And those point to very fundamental inherited differences. And so I developed that quite a bit in the work. And I think that's one of the most useful ways to think about this. But then for most people, the best thing to do is to just kind of step down from that and to just think in terms of specific personality traits, because it's very practical that way. Now, what we use in the book, we use the OCEAN approach, which is the Big Five personality theory, and that's the most common personality theory that's used by academics worldwide. There are a few other ones that are used, but not anywhere near as much in terms of doing rigorous research. And those Big Five traits are all broken up into two different pieces, so there's kind of Big Ten. Does that make sense? There's 10 parts to our personality. And five of those have very significant differences in ideology. And two of them in particular are the ones that really drive the difference. And the first one that I'll talk about, which is the conservatives are stronger with, is orderliness. Now, orderliness, when you hear the term, you just sort of think that people kind of, I don't know, they put their knife and fork and spoon in the right place, they show up at work on time, they get worried about things. And that's certainly a decent sort of start to what orderliness is. There's no question about that. But it's a very, very fundamental driving feature for conservatives. They're much stronger than we are in it. And we tend to, as liberals, we tend to think of orderliness as this kind of an accountant's task, you know, or a bookkeeper's task. And it's really, again, much more fundamental than that. I break it down into 8 different pieces, which we don't need to go into here, but just to just kind of rattle them off to give you a notion of how each one is important. One of the big problems that we have as liberals is that consistency is really huge when you're orderly. And we as liberals, we tend to be much less consistent, and that need for consistency on the right really drives us crazy. The need for certainty, the feeling of certainty, of feeling like you're certain in life, that's something that really drives orderly people a lot more than people that are low at orderliness. And then finally, something I just want to mention that people don't think about much, but is a general principle, and that comes from a psychological theory, and it's boundary work. It's the notion of having thick boundaries or thin boundaries in your life. And that includes, you know, family, country, state, but it also kind of goes up and down, like between your kids and you, or your boss and you, or, you know, your president and you. And conservatives, because of their orderliness, they tend to have relatively thick and relatively well-defined boundaries, and they talk about them a lot, and they're very, very important, and they play into things like being more competitive, being more certain, being more black and white, that these are all aspects of a boundary approach to life. So that's the conservative strength of orderliness, which I go into a fair amount right at the beginning of the book. Turning to us,
Can I interrupt you for just a sec?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So the conservative personality, you said there were 2 main things. One was orderliness, and what's the other one?
I just mentioned the one trait. There are several traits that are important for them, but the main trait is orderliness that I was just going over.
Okay.
And then there's components to that. I use a number of different ones, but the ones I mentioned were consistency, which we have a real hard time with. We're not consistent. I mean, we're not as consistent. We're not as fanatical about consistency. And then certainty and boundaries.
Great. So I didn't mean to divert you. You were about to give us some of the major descriptors or characteristics of the liberal personality, right?
Yes, yes. Now liberals are high in openness. And openness is a very misunderstood. It's such a lovely word. It makes us sound so good. And maybe we are, you know. But actually, openness has a number of different sort of elements to it that aren't as well known to the public. And one is that we tend to be sensitive to emotional information, more sensitive. We tend to be very interested in detail, and we're interested in very specific situations. And this is where it gets a little bit harder to explain without the neurological component of this argument. But we are much less interested in sort of overarching principles and putting together a set of beliefs and putting together theses and organizing ourselves logically. That is more a province of people who are orderly. For people that are open, we are interested in the vast detail, the opportunities, the widely different kinds of things that can happen in life. We love variety. We tend to moralize diversity. While if you can imagine this, even on the other side, they tend to treat diversity, at least psychically, as somewhat immoral for all kinds of, I think, perfectly good reasons, perfectly rational reasons. So that that split between the two of us, that's just so huge. It is a direct personality conflict that comes up over and over and over again. If you think about those 2 different things, I mean, just as a for instance, just to go through a couple of things, you can say that if you're open, then you have a much higher chance of being someone who's adventurous. But then on the orderliness side, there's a you can pair that and say, okay, well, what are your chances of being adventurous and cautious at the same time, which is the way that orderly people are. You know, it's possible. Mountain climbers do that, right? But that's a really tough thing to do, you know? And there's a reason why these two characteristics, openness and orderliness, are pretty strongly negatively correlated, meaning they don't show up at the same time in the same individual. It's not common for an artistic person to also be really dutiful, you know, or a person that's really imaginative to be very orderly, or a person that's fantasy-oriented to be really organized. You know, it happens. I think you're this way, Karen, actually, but it's not that common. And so that's what we're dealing with, a wide statistical difference that ends up making these sort of lumps of people in these two loose clumps of personality that make for a lot of these problems.
Scott, here's a sentence that you've written in your book that I underlined. You say, to restate the heart of the whole effort, most of the progress toward understanding and working with conservatives is made through understanding ourselves and ourselves better. Can you unpack that?
I can try. I mean, I'm always trying to do that myself. I don't think that if we generalize that for just a moment, which I would really like to do, you know, the best way to understand other people is to understand ourselves. The best way to forgive other people is to forgive ourselves. You know, and these are just kind of, I think, really important truisms that we all as human beings should try to inculcate in our own lives. And so this is just merely, in that sense, this is just merely a specific version of that very general advice. I don't think I was saying anything that was particularly radical. And in fact, you know, as you go through the book, there's just many examples where it just really makes sense to understand, let's say, how you're orderly in your life. Now, one of the things about any of these traits, orderliness, openness, everyone has, there's massive variety in what it means for a person to be orderly, you know. Just like for somebody who's open, you know, they may like the opera, or they could like all kinds of different TV shows, or they could like dancing, you know. It's just, the world is just full of all kinds of different ways to be orderly and different ways to be open. But the thing that's really cool about personality stuff is that if you have a part of yourself that is orderly, however it is, and every liberal that I know is orderly in some way, well, not everyone, but almost everyone, you can ponder and think about the ways that you're not orderly in a good way, because all personality traits are good. They're not good if they have too little or too much of them. But as we look at the way that our personality traits drive our lives, we can discover in personality terms where our orderliness, like for me, my orderliness is pretty limited, you know? And so I've been, particularly through this research, the 6 years that I've been working on this, I think much more systematically now about ways that I can improve in being orderly. And what I discovered quite accidentally through that process was understanding that I understand orderliness much better now as a result of fighting my own weaknesses and problems with it, so that I come to the table with conservatives with much more respect for not only what they bring to the table, but also with what they struggle with, you know, what it is that a orderly viewpoint, you know, hurts in your analysis, what it is that you give up by being really orderly. And what it does is it makes you much more compassionate about them because you understand them better. So you, instead of running over to morality with all your thinking, you know, right away, just kind of, God, this guy is so rigid, you know.
He's judgments.
Yes, we can back off a little bit and just understand it more in terms of inherited personality and their perspective.
Well, I'm glad you said that. That is one thing that's very interesting about the book, is you do look at quite a number of sort of traits and sub-traits, and you look at the bright side and the dark side of all those traits, and I agree that that does allow you to think more compassionately about people who don't share your traits as well as about your own traits. But speaking of struggling against our sort of what we experience as our natures, do you want to say a few words about the role, the neurological science you looked at, and the role of nature versus nurture in this divide?
Well, those are two different subjects in a way.
Okay.
Nature versus nurture is often, and I have spent I've spent the last 6 years just kind of up to my neck in nature versus nurture types of things, because you really have to tease that stuff out. But in fact, they work together in virtually every social psychological situation. The two are just completely intertwined, and mostly sort of coincidentally, we have very solid evidence that personality is somewhere between 50% and 70% purely inherited, however you want to define that. And with the rest of it, but what's interesting about it is that the rest of it is very, very mysterious, because you can take away parents and it doesn't change. You can take away early parts of life. You can take away education, all kinds of things. And they can't really put their finger on what experience or nurture really is. That's one of the amazing things about this field, is that people are just really, really clueless about what constitutes a human being still. You know, even though genetically they can put their finger on about half of us, but the rest of us, it's just this sort of weird guess. And it's kind of fun, I think, because it means that there's a lot of opportunity, a lot of sort of open-endedness to us as human beings, which I really appreciate about the science. On the neurology side, basically, our brains are split into two different pieces. And you hear about left-brained and right-brained all the time. And there's a sort of grain of truth to the left brain and right brain types of things that most of us use, you know, about being sort of analytical with the left brain and being more sort of artistic or improvisatory with the right brain. Well, it turns out that there is a tremendous amount of wonderful science that has been going on since the late 60s. And I did a lot of research and found sort of 19 different personality characteristics for the left brain and the right brain. And you can do that because people had their brains actually cut between them, so that you can actually wander over to the left side and have a conversation with the right brain. And then you can do the opposite on the other side. And so there are some very well-established personality characteristics of the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. And it turns out that, you know, being a little bit broad brush about it, we've got a conservative over on the left side of our head, and we've got a liberal on the right side. And a lot of what we're doing when we make decisions in life is we're choosing between a sort of process-oriented mindset in a given situation, right? Whether we're driving down the road or deciding whether we want to go to a store, or we're climbing up a dark set of stairs, or, you know, all these normal drama of life. We're either choosing to follow an established role, a process, which is, if you think about it, a very complicated thing. You've got memories, and you've got to enact things that you did before and all that. Or you could be making a choice to do something that is exceptional for whatever reason, like suddenly you can't depend on your eyes on the way up the stairs, and so you have to feel your way around. Well, that's right hemisphere stuff. That's the side that is involved in more learning and improvisatory and checking out, instead of thinking about patterns, thinking about what's exactly in front of you right then, you know, without a lot of thinking about how you used to do it or did do it or whatever. So these two viewpoints that are in personality terms are represented by orderliness and openness. These are fundamentally, philosophically fundamental needs that all of us as human beings need to do just in order to get our regular lives done. So that's why I say that ideology, in the sense that we think of ideology, is as fundamental as it gets.
Scott, you've mentioned three of the foundational values of conservatives: orderliness, certainty, and boundaries. But I found the other ones very important, too. Security, hierarchy, tradition, consistency, simplicity. Would you like to say a few words about those fundamental values?
Sure, you bet. And I'm sorry, I was just kind of highlighting, just trying to illustrate that orderliness wasn't bookkeeping, you know. But we can go through it in a little more detail. As I mentioned, consistency is really important to them. And one way to think about that is that need for certainty that orderliness is kind of built around. I should make a distinction and say the need for feeling certain is that's so basic to their personalities. Consistency is really just kind of a hidden form of certainty. It's really certainty over time. That's what it means. A routine that works well and a plan and everything predictably in its place, you know. This is why flip-flopping is considered such a major character flaw by conservatives, you know. It's inconsistent. And I remember being swayed by that during the Kerry, John Kerry's run for presidency. And then I remember waking up and saying, wait a minute, I want him to flip-flop, you know. But that is an orderliness type of thing, is that inflexibility, that rigidity has value in and of itself because it makes you feel certain. Now, simplicity is orderliness's way of molding the world into explainable parts, you know, and just making it more certain. It's really hard to make things certain that are really complicated. It sort of confuses you, and you're always trying to figure out pieces of it that don't make sense and all that.
Boy, I feel a link to the climate change and the question of scientific uncertainty coming on, but we do have to take a short break for a moment. So let's let folks know a little bit more about the station.
Yeah, this is KWMR, Community Radio for West Marin.
Great. And this is Post Carbon Radio on KWMR. Today, we're talking with author and social psychologist Scott Wagner about his book, The Liberal's Guide to Conservatives. Well, Scott, your book is very full and there's much to talk about. And we've already used half our hour. So I actually want to check in with you about what we do for the second half, because we have lots of questions. But we also could open the phone lines to see if listeners want to call in questions. Would you be open to that?
Yeah, let's open the phone lines. I mean, I suspect people will want to talk about climate change, which is would be lovely to go to. I think I think we know enough now to be able to just kind of run from these things that we talked about to something more practical. I'd love to do that.
Okay,
listeners, you can call in if you have questions or comments on 415-663-8317. That's 663-8317.
Okay. So by way of segue into talking about climate, one of the things that you emphasize is sort of things we get wrong and things we do wrong when we're talking with conservatives, or listening, which you also write a lot about. And I want to just highlight one of them, and maybe you could launch from that place.
Sure.
One of the things you say is the liberal sense of intellectual superiority is the number one complaint of conservatives about us. How does that relate to climate change, and why do we do that?
Oh, gosh, why do we do that? I think that's too much for right now.
Okay.
But the general idea is that we are openness in the personality spectrum. There's a very strong correlation between openness and intelligence. And it turns out that we have a very strong connection between our intellect and our openness. And we tend to moralize both. And so as a result, we have these sort of just kind of personality weaknesses, and one of which is, we get pretty know-it-all pretty easily.
Can you say what you mean by moralizing those things? Just explain it.
Yeah, sure. Any personality trait that you're really strong in, you begin to moralize it, meaning that you think in terms of good and evil that way. And this is the problem that we have with orderly conservatives, because now things have to be certain, and they have to be consistent, you know. And we have to be absolutely certain about security, for instance, when we can't be, and those kinds of things. And they'll run us ragged, you know, moralizing on those things to make sure that we, you know, we absolutely are, that we can't change traditional marriage, for instance, because that would be inconsistent, and those kinds of things. So that's what moralizing means.
And how do liberals moralize from our openness and our sense of intellectual superiority? What do we do?
Well, that's a good question. One thing that we do is we do moralize diversity. And you know, it's a tough thing to talk about with a liberal crowd. It's a tough thing to talk about with anybody and say, hey, you know, you guys tend to do this. But that's one thing that we do as open people. We also moralize art in general. We moralize individual conditions over process. For instance, the classic problem that we have, I'm a police brutality activist, and what we often deal with is we have a clash where the orderly people are taking care of the process and moralizing the process, and the open people are taking care of the individual and moralizing the poor exception to the process. And both sides can be, you know, distinctly blind in pretty patterned ways.
So let's jump from there to climate change. What do we do wrong classically as liberals when we're talking with conservatives about climate change? What are some of our cardinal sins?
I think this is difficult, and I want to have a conversation more than I want to just kind of spout my truths around this, because I also just want to make clear that this is where I'm crossing a fence here over from stuff that I know to things that I think and that I believe because I know stuff, okay?
Opinion is welcome and disclaimed as such.
Okay. With climate change, one huge problem that we make is this sort of, I mean, you mentioned intellectual superiority. We are very, very big on people understanding that climate change is absolutely happening. And now I believe that climate change is absolutely happening, okay? It's not that I think that that's wrong. It's the grinding nature of the way that we get that across. Because the thing is, we don't have to convince people that it is 100% right. We only have to convince them that it's something like, I don't know, 70% right or 75% right. And it turns out, in my mind, having done a lot of wandering around with climate change, that it's quite reasonable for fairly reasonable people to think that stuff is pretty open. I mean, when you hear the arguments of climate deniers, I can't listen to them very long anymore, but when I did, you know, you can hear these ways that it just makes sense. Things like, oh, well, the climate goes up and down, or gosh, climate only changed by 0.8 of a degree. What difference can that kind of make? And these are powerful arguments for normal people, and it's reasonable for the normal human being to kind of question these things. But instead, our response, instead of treating that as reasonable and being patient, which is a real key with conservatives in general, is this sort of impatient and know-it-allness of us that says, look, you know, you don't have the right to think that way because so much is at stake, you know, all these arguments that we make as people that are passionately involved in climate change.
Well, that seems difficult because on the one hand, you're saying we only have to convince people to 70%, but on the other hand, you're saying the conservative personality wants certainty.
Yes, that's absolutely right. So you're right. It's really difficult. I'm not saying that there's a solution. I'm just saying that this is one of the huge problems that we have, is that we very quickly can get impolite and act as if we are climate scientists ourselves, so that we totally understand it to the point of 100% knowledge, when we don't. We just simply don't. For us, it's probably, you know, maybe it's 98% right or 99% right. I mean, this comes back to this sort of essentialism stuff. It's like, and then the other issue is, you know, what does it really mean that there's human-caused climate change, right? And this is one of my real difficulties, is that why must we feel so absolutely certain that humans are causing it? Why can't we just focus on the climate change itself and make some headway on that point, you know, as kind of a part of our strategy? And this is something that I'm very frustrated about, because we know that climate change is actually occurring. We know that every year it gets a little bit hotter. And there are a lot of people that can be convinced outside of the anthropological argument to make some fundamental changes. But by really grinding away on anthropological change, we can tend to off-put.
I guess that one seems hard, because I think, you know, as someone who is an activist around the issue and also trained in the science, it is because we can detect the human this human impact signal that we think humans need to take measures. And if it were just natural climate variability, then there would be no case for human intervention to stop it.
Well, okay, yes. There's two things here, and with climate change, you have to look at it as kind of a portfolio, in my opinion, of different things. I mean, what your point of view and working on anthropological climate change is very important, and I don't want to take away from that.
Or anthropogenic.
Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is that, well, let me just back up for a moment. I go in the epilogue of the book, I go through this process that's like a 7-stage process for conservatives to get from being certain about their thing that is wrong all the way to being certain to the thing that is right. And for climate change, we are into year 45 now, about, and we're about halfway through that process by my little essay on the point. And one of the things that we need to do is to give them excuses to be able to move along with us. What we often do in all of our activism is we neglect the tremendous amount of unconscious motivation that's involved in these processes, and oftentimes their conscious mind is convinced in some ways, but their unconscious mind is the boss. Mm-hmm. It is not, you know, just kind of dragging along behind. It's quite opposite than how most people model what's going on in life, and so a lot of what we need to do is to give these people an excuse to be able to move along with us.
And is that like face saving?
Yeah, it's face-saving, yes it is, but it's more than that. It's really, there's something called the left brain interpreter in there that is constantly sort of trying to find meaning in what's going on. And that meaning can be altered really significantly in kind of these whacked ways, and we are not good at understanding that about orderly people. We're good at looking at them and going, wow, they have all these crazy thoughts. But one thing that we should be doing is also thinking, well, we should be giving them some half thoughts and three-quarter thoughts and things that might make a little bit of sense so that they can start to work with us. For instance, just recently I was looking at, there's 5 places, all of them in the South, that are just really at risk from climate change. But right now they're really at risk from tidal change and from storms and things like that. And if the left was able to focus on those places in Louisiana and South Carolina and down at the bottom of Florida and some other places, and begin to give people an excuse to be able to recruit themselves into dealing with risk of water on the coast, right, which doesn't sound like anthropogenic climate change, but is an in for people. And if we could get people to collate that with the notion of doing infrastructure improvements, you know, and getting jobs happening around things like that, then we're making a step forward, even though it's an unconscious step forward, even though it doesn't seem like we're attacking anthropogenic climate change directly.
So is that saying that people don't see sea level rise as a climate change symptom or outcome?
They, as far as I can tell on the right, they don't understand that sea level rise is anything but just really tiny at this point. And it's true, I guess, compared to where it's going to go. It's not that much, but it's significant, like I said, right now in these 5 places that, you know, that we've gone up a few inches here in the last 80, 90 years.
Yeah, just this morning I was hearing news coverage of this possibility of naming the CEO of ExxonMobil to head the State Department. And right. they were talking in terms of sea level rise on the order of 5 or 6 inches. And that's, you know, an order of magnitude below what's projected by the end of the century. So it's amazing right. to me that people in positions of authority and knowledge don't even know, like, basic facts, although I'm not sure they gave a time frame. But anyway.
Let's talk about that for a moment, because I think it's urgent to just kind of step away from the general point for a moment. I mean, we've been talking about liberals and conservatives. Conservatives have two different kinds of extremists for two different psychic reasons. They have authoritarians, which most people, you know, think of as this sort of bossy kind of person that's in charge, like Trump. But actually, Trump is more the other kind. He's what's called SDO, which is social domination orientation, which means, you know, you say he's a winner, and that's supposed to mean something. You know, it's the notion that life is a battle, and that you have to just kind of kick butt in order to win. There's no real win-win. It's just a world of winners and losers.
And may I just jump in to say, isn't it also moralized that winning is good just because you won?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes. And these are the extremists that we're dealing with today. And what's going on in the climate battle, and it's not just climate, but it's everywhere, and it's largely outside of the work that I do, which is mostly working on focusing on individual liberals and conservatives. Conservatives are extremely social. They're social in a way that we just simply don't understand as liberals. They think together. That's part of being orderly. It's part of being process-driven. It's one of the reasons why they're so polite, for instance. You know, it's just they really grease the wheels around working together. Well, that makes them really, really susceptible to extremists that poke them around certainty, security, hierarchy, boundaries, all these things that we've been talking about.
You mean susceptible and to so being upset?
Susceptible to being influenced.
Okay.
To the point where we are now in this sort of beyond truthiness mode right now, where now we have trained whole Mongol hordes of America, and I think it's especially shocking on the religious side. We've trained them that there are these values that, forgive me, Trump, you know, honesty, integrity, these kinds of things that Americans traditionally value. And so the extremists have taken over our government in a very real sense. And I know I'm being really partisan here, and I guess I can apologize to some of the viewers here, but or listeners, but for me, it's just science. I mean, we have a president-elect who has who, when they did PolitiFact, he came up with a 4% truth rating. He over 70% of what he has said is at least mostly false. You know, this is an extremism that has taken over the country in a way that to allow them to be able to deny climate change. And so, you know, the reason why I wanted to mention this is that you can't have the conversation about climate change and say, oh, well, how do we get across to conservatives without mentioning, you know, what Noam Chomsky relates so well, which is that these are people who lie for various reasons. And they are also very deluded for some of the reasons that I talked about, but also in combination with groupthink and some of the biases that I cover.
Scott, I ran across an important percentage that I was wondering what you thought about. 42% of the electorate didn't vote or go to the polls. What does that say to you?
I think it's a couple things. One is I don't think we energize people properly on the left. And I think that they generally are just kind of disaffected because they don't really believe that government has much to do with them.
On the left, you think?
I think both, yeah, especially on the left. I mean, we did really poorly with millennials and with minorities this time around. It didn't show up. We had 10 million less Democratic voters this time. than we had in 2008. You know, it's a stunning difference. And it made all the difference in the world when we had 70,000 people that basically determined the future of America in three states. So that, you know, that's really hitting us. But I mean, it's happening on the right side as well. They're not showing up to the same degree either. But, you know, I'm seeing it from this sort of general disillusionment side that I think we're really struggling with in America, because we have a government that, for whatever reason, is just seen to be completely removed, you know, from people's lives.
So, Scott, I want to sort of tie a couple things together as we continue to think about, really what's amounting to the last few minutes of the show, strategies for going forward, how we can talk about climate in particular, how we deal with individuals as we head into holiday, you know, dinner tables. But one of the contradictions that really strikes me is we've just been talking about, you called it sort of post-truthiness. Some people are calling it post-fact America. That on the one hand, conservatives say that the most annoying thing about you liberals is your sense of intellectual superiority. And yet there are studies showing that people who watch Fox are like worse informed than people who don't watch any news at all. And there really is a fact gap. How do we deal with that?
I think there's two ways that I can think of as doing it, and they are in direct opposition. And this is why I wanted to bring up the sort of reactionary element that we're dealing with that is in charge and sort of swaying people. You know, that is a toxic influence, and it's one that we need to fight overtly and directly as activists. And there's no way around that. We simply have to call the truth as we see it. And we need to do it as creatively and as directly as we can. I think we need to really go with the playbook of the 60s and be able to start doing boycotts much more effectively, and these kinds of things that can really make a difference with companies like Chevron and Shell Oil, who mouth the words of climate change and then do these lovely ads showing how responsible they are environmentally, and then work behind the scenes with the American Petroleum Institute to do everything that they can to make sure that climate change is absolutely avoided at the policy level. And of course they do that with money. You know, that's not a let's be nice and understand thing. That is a direct activism mandate on our part. And that's what I'm hoping America can get energized this spring with this ridiculous president that we've had, so that we can really move ahead on that front, united for the first time in 50 years. Because activism, as far as I'm concerned, is a really terrible. We're just not good at it right now. On the other side, though, and I think this is just as important, is that we need to understand. And I don't mean to think of conservatives as children, because I don't think that's fair. But at the same time, we need to understand that half of America is highly influenceable, highly social, and driven in these ways, and we have enormous impact with individuals. And this is the biggest lesson that I can pass on to people after three long tours of the United States, talking to hundreds of conservatives in all kinds of different conditions, is that we have no idea how powerful it is to have someone who is patient and kind and who is agreeable and flexible with an individual, sitting down with them to be able to influence them about things that are true. And beyond that, we have, I think it's very important to be inclusive in the normal sense, to be tolerant, to be kind, even with people that are just plain wrong, and understand that their mindsets are driven by something that is much bigger than them, you know? And that having that distance from sort of, you know, running right to, oh, these people are evil, gives us a lot of capability within our families and within our friends to really actually have some impact on climate change and lots of other things.
Let's end with listening, not because it's an afterthought, but because it's so important. We wanted to leave our listeners with it as a closing thought. Tell us how to listen effectively to people we may disagree with seriously, especially if we are liberals listening to conservatives.
Boy, what a big subject, Tom. In the work, I try to emphasize that mechanically, it takes about a third of the time that we have listening to people to actually understand. You know, to do the sort of logic switch arounds in your head to get the words, get the concepts, and be able to run with it. That means that two thirds of the time, we can be thinking about what it is that they're saying, but I, in my own personal experience, but also in other studies, have shown that we don't do that. Our mind wanders around. We actually spend a lot of that two-thirds of the time trying to make sure that we can either offset what they're saying or add to it in some way that makes us feel good. Or
getting ready to reply, right?
Yeah, right. Thank you. Getting ready to reply. And actually, the notion of curiosity, that time is precious and that this is the real moment here, that this person that's in front of you right now is all you have in life, that urgency to really make this time matter, that this is the reality, the person in front of you and what it is that they're saying, that in a very general sense is a hugely important way to kind of approach our lives so that our minds aren't wandering. You know, so in a way it comes back to sort of meditation types of, you know, philosophy and orientation around life. I do want to say specifically that the value of listening is that it what it does is it gives you an opportunity to see the situation from their side, yes, which can be really valuable. It lets you see ways to talk about the situation that you weren't able to before, which is also really, really valuable. Mm-hmm. And it lets you get some kind of way of being with them. And that's a little harder to describe, but it's, put it this way. I've had conversations, many, many conversations with conservatives where 10 minutes in, I have to warn them that I'm not conservative. I already said that at the beginning. But I have to tell them I'm not conservative, and the reason why is because I'm finding so many things to agree with them about that they are including me in their in-group. And when you're in the in-group, you have lots more influence, and I like that. I love that. But at the same time, I want them to understand, you know, I have a different way of looking at the world.
I'm an alien in your midst.
Yeah, and listening can be so powerful that way in terms of being able to get into that in-group. And it's just a matter of asking questions and going, oh, gosh, you know, I never thought of it that way, or that's a good point every once in a while.
Yeah.
And, of course, really believing it.
Well, you know, unfortunately, I sense you have more to say on this, but unfortunately, it's about time for us to wrap up. We've been speaking with author and social psychologist Scott Wagner about his new book, The Liberal's Guide to Conservatives. There's a lot more in there. Some of it's very funny. A lot of it's very personal. It's wonderful metaphors. And urge people to get a copy of that. Tell us, is the book about to come out in a new edition?
No, same thing. Okay. I had to correct some sins from the first printing, but now it's all done. And yeah, and I have it on the printing version and the electronic version, and I have an audiobook version as well. Through
great. And where can people follow you?
I'm at reachtheright.com, and then I will have liberalsguide.com up in about a month.
Great. Well, we're going to have to call it. So thank you so much, Scott Wagner. That's it for Post Carbon Radio. And stay tuned for Rick Clark and Cruisin'.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is...